Chapter 19. His First Bow. 2 days later, Lestrade comes home to the smell of cooking, and Effie waiting for him at a table that has been beautifully laid. The two of them have barely seen each other in the past 48 hours. Following the breakup of the Red Circle, the destruction of the maglev train, and the arrest of the three terrorists, Lestrade and Hopkins have been working day and night. There have been meetings at government level, high-level discussions about how much real news the police will be allowed to release. Nobody wants to admit that almost 400 people were actually murdered, nor that some of the most successful companies in the world were, at least partly, complicit. At the same time, they have begun a nationwide search for anyone else who might have been involved in the conspiracy. They still don't know who killed Silas Welburn, or who broke into Dost Akbar's office and left the warning that led to his death. And then there are the six men at Paddington Old Cemetery. These may not seem important in the scheme of things, but it's always the same in the wake of a major scandal. It's the smallest fish that get drawn into the net. So Lestrade has been run off his feet. Even so, he understands that he has been deliberately avoiding Effie and the conversation they must have. He knows that she has been waiting for this moment too. She has prepared a special supper. He can smell mushrooms and meat, and the table has been carefully laid with the best plates, a bottle of wine, candlesticks. The last time the dining room was like this was probably after the birth of Ollie. As for Ollie, he's already in bed. Lestrade goes up to see him, reads him a story, tucks him in, and turns off the lights. Pausing at the door, Lestrade looks back on the slumbering face of what could be a normal, healthy child, and wonders why moments like this have been so rare in his life. He knows what he has to do. First and foremost, he is doing it for Ollie. And so to the table. Effie has brought out some wine. It's actually French. A 2040 Bordeaux, and she must have gone out and bought it, for surely they had nothing like it in the house. She serves the first course, mushroom soup. Lestrade opens the wine, and they eat companionably, talking about what has happened over the past 2 days, while carefully skirting around what they both know is the main issue. "This is very nice," Lestrade says. "You've been so busy, I bet you haven't been eating." "It's been quite a circus." "You must be pleased with yourself."
"I am."
Hell with it. Why can't Lestrade boast for a moment? The Red Circle, we got the name right, as it happens. That's what they were calling themselves. Harry Webb and his brother were brilliant in their own way. They'd used their time inside to invent a new crime, slow-motion blackmail. They were demanding enough money to make themselves rich, but not so much as to frighten off their victims. Biogenesis and the rest of them found it easier and more convenient to pay. And they'd have got away with it if Dost Akbar hadn't broken ranks and gone against them.
"Will you pour the wine?"
"Of course." Lestrade wonders what Effie paid for it and where it came from. He pours two small glasses. Neither of them makes a toast. They drink.
"You sound as if you admire them," Effie says.
"I don't. They were monsters. They were prepared to kill any number of people to pursue their crimes. I think of the passengers on Flight 356. They were the real victims in this, not the businesses. There were mothers and children on that plane. Could have been you and Ollie.
We'd never have enough money to fly.
And what of the rough sleepers out there on Richmond Park? They had almost nothing. They just needed somewhere to spend the night. 90 of them died.
So what will happen now?"
"Paperwork. It's a nuisance, but there are a lot of things to follow up." He smiles. "Sherlock Holmes has agreed to work with us."
"You like him, don't you?"
"He's extraordinary. I've never met anyone like him. I've told you this already. I think he's exactly what we need. An outsider, someone untainted, a man who can carry the flag."
"What for?"
"I don't know. Justice? The rule of law?" Lestrade stops himself. He doesn't usually come out with such lofty pronouncements. "He has a remarkable brain," he goes on. "At the end of the day, it was just luck that brought me to Harry and Samuel Webb. The Red Circle. There'd been a similar case in Canary Wharf, and although I hadn't made the arrest, I managed to pull up the files and I immediately recognized the man who called himself Dominic.
But Holmes had got there on his own, ahead of me. It's true he did about £1 billion worth of damage blowing up the train, but he did what he thought was right, and I suppose that's something to admire. Incidentally, I haven't mentioned that little detail to the chief superintendent. I said the switch short-circuited. Won't help us if Mr. Holmes spends the next 10 years behind bars. And what about you, George? Will they promote you? Lestrade sighs and puts down his wine. He feels bad drinking, as if in celebration. That's not what this evening is about, and it's time to face up to the reason why the two of them are having this dinner. The chief superintendent is leaving, you know that. He has sounded me out in his own way, but I wouldn't be interested. I have a team. Stan Hopkins and the rest of them. We may have different ranks, but we're all on the same level, doing what we can. We'd had a rough year up to this. Losing Kate Nelson was the worst of it, but there were other setbacks too. I wouldn't be happy sitting upstairs on my own. The moment has come. He can't put it off any longer. Anyway, I'm leaving. Are you? I've spoken to Boss Meat, Effie. As a matter of fact, it turns out that they were one of the companies being targeted by Red Circle, so they were more than happy to hear from me. It looks like I'm a shoo-in for the job. He goes on quickly before she can interrupt. There's to be a formal interview in a couple of weeks. I have to wait until then because I can't be recruited by them while I'm in the middle of a police investigation. But once the dust has settled, it'll seem perfectly natural. They certainly need someone to look at their security procedures and, as you say, they're willing to pay. Have you told Hopkins? Not yet. But you've decided. I owe you an apology. I love you, Effie. And Ollie. I don't need to tell you that, but I can see that I've neglected you. If you're unhappy here, we can't stay. You're right. We'll have a healthier and maybe a happier life in Brighton. A new start, and you'll be closer to your sister too. Effie has stopped eating. She lays down her knife and fork, reaches out, and rests her hands on his. We're not going, she says. What? A long pause. Then, I'm the one who's sorry, George. What I said to you... It's true that I've been feeling so low and lonely recently, but I can't take you away from London. This job, being a policeman, is part of you. It's who you are. And if you came to Brighton, how long would it be before we were at each other's throats? I'd do it for you, Effie. I know, and I love you for it, but I was wrong to ask. What you've done with the Red Circle is part of it. You've proved to me that if we try hard enough, maybe we can make things better. Give the world back a sense of right and wrong. She smiles. Anyway, I talked to Ollie. He doesn't want to leave his friends. He's getting so much better every day that maybe I can go back to teaching. You don't like this house. I don't like its history, but it's a fine house. Effie, I would do anything for you. I'm ready to go. I don't want you to go, George. I want us to find a way back to how things were. I want us to stay. There are tears in her eyes, picked out by the candlelight. Are you sure, Effie? Are you sure? The food is forgotten. The two of them get up from the table and fall into each other's arms. There are three people waiting at 221 Baker Street. They have not come to consult Sherlock Holmes. One is a woman with a bad cough. Next to her is a ferryman with his hand wrapped in a dirty bandage. The third, in the uniform of a postman, is shivering, although the evening is not particularly cold. They have all come to see John Watson. It seems that Edward Boyce, whose diabetes is now under control, has talked to lots of people about the extraordinary man he met at Victoria Station, and they in turn have spread the word. Here's a doctor who charges a reasonable amount and who actually has the commitment and the patience to look after them. He spends time with each and every one of them, refers the most seriously ill to his friend George Adalgee at St. Thomas's Hospital, but treats the majority of them himself. John is now earning almost enough money to support the entire household. He is working in the living room, which has been converted into a full-time surgery. He is helped by Missy, who is considering packing in her job at the hospital. As a nurse, she was rushed off her feet. part of a system that often seemed to do everything it could to prevent its employees from doing their job. But here, she can actually see the results. The smiling patients, the sense of gratitude reflected in the little gifts they often bring in addition to their payments. This is the reason she became a nurse, and she loves watching John at work. He is a different man. The hospital porter is far behind him. They will not have to put up with this makeshift arrangement for much longer. Lestrade has been busy on their behalf, and workmen have already moved into the building occupied by the Red Circle and have begun the work of turning three houses into two. Quite soon, John will have a proper surgery with an outside office for Missy and a small waiting room for his patients. He won't call it that, of course. He has too many bad memories of the so-called waiting room at the hospital. When the new house is finished, they will actually enter through the door of what was 221B, and Missy has decided that she wants to keep the new number. She announced it one day at breakfast. "Why would you want to do that?" John asked her. "I don't know. I suppose it's because I'm making a fresh start. I've got you two to look after now, and it's time I put Finn behind me. Anyway, I think 221B has got a nice ring to it, and it will save having the door changed." So 221B will be the new address. It already feels familiar. If John and Missy have one concern, it is their lodger, who is spending much of his time in his room upstairs. Sherlock Holmes has not been himself since the Red Circle was closed down. To be triumphant was never in his nature, but he seems almost disappointed by his success. He spends long hours on his own, gripped by a sort of melancholy that's so acute that John wonders if he needs medical attention. Missy is less worried. "He's just bored," she says. "You know how clever he is, John. He needs something to occupy his mind." But that something may be less wholesome than either of them would wish. A few nights ago, Holmes went out on his own. He was furtive when he got home again and disappeared into his room, locking the door for the first time. Neither of them saw him again for 48 hours, and when he emerged, his eyes were glazed, his skin unhealthy, his hair in disarray. Missy knew the symptoms, although she could not bring herself to believe it. Is Sherlock Holmes taking drugs? They have agreed that they will talk to him about it, but not yet. They will wait until the building works are complete. They know that he has been in discussions with Lestrade, and maybe something else will turn up to occupy his extraordinary intellect. Everything will be fine. It is 7:30, and John has just dealt with his last patient. The shivering man needed to raise his blood sugar levels, and is thinking about dinner when the doorbell rings. "You're not seeing anyone else tonight, John," Missy says, firmly. "I can manage one more." "Absolutely not. We don't need the money, and you're going to make yourself ill if you're not careful. I'll ask them to come back tomorrow." Missy goes to the door, but she sees at once that their new visitor is not a patient. There is a car parked outside the house. Not broken down, not horse-drawn, the sort of car she has never seen before. Black, gleaming, immaculate, the leaping Jaguar on the hood identifies the car as an almost priceless mark, not manufactured during Missy's lifetime. A uniformed chauffeur is standing at the door, holding a cardboard box fastened with string. "Yes," Missy says. "I wonder if it would be possible to speak to Mr. Sherlock Holmes," the chauffeur asks. He is a middle-aged man, bald, neatly presented, wearing spectacles. Missy does not recognize him and stands on the doorstep, suspicious. Her first thought is that this is one of the businessmen who was being blackmailed by the Red Circle. Have they come to present him with some token of their gratitude? From what she's heard, it doesn't sound at all in character. "Who shall I say is calling?" Missy asks. "It's all right, Missy," the voice comes from behind her. "I'll see them." Sherlock Holmes must have seen the car arrive from an upper window. He's come downstairs, wearing a dressing gown and slippers. He still looks tired and a little ravaged, but at least there is focus to his eyes. "You're going to catch a cold dressed like that," Missy says, but she stands aside, allowing Holmes to face the chauffeur. "We haven't met, the chauffeur begins. That's not quite true, Holmes replies. He never forgets a face, not even one he has merely glimpsed. You were the receptionist at the Bohemia. The chauffeur smiles. Forgive me. It wasn't my intention to deceive you. I merely meant that we hadn't met formally. It's true. I work for Miss Irene Adler. She asked me to give you this, as a sincere token of her esteem, and her apologies for misleading you when she met you at the club. She led me into a trap. Miss Adler wants you to understand that she acted against her better instincts, and did so with grave misgivings. The words are perhaps well chosen, considering she sent Holmes to a cemetery. She hopes you will understand that she had her own well-being and that of her staff to consider. There are sadly many informers amongst the clientele who frequent the Bohemia. You had arrived without any attempt at disguise, and it was quite likely that you had been recognized. Had she decided not to act the way she did, she would have put her entire enterprise in danger. She might have warned me. She was confident that you would find a way to prevail. And she was right. The chauffeur smiles. At any event, she hopes you will accept this gift with her warmest good wishes. She also adds that you and your friends will always be welcome at the Bohemia, should you choose to return. Won't we need dog biscuits? There are several included with the package. The chauffeur presses the cardboard box into Holmes's hands. Judging from its size, it could hold a large bouquet of flowers, but it is quite a bit heavier and well packed. There are no moving parts. Holmes watches as the chauffeur goes back to the car and climbs into the driving seat. He starts the engine, but just before the Jaguar moves off, a figure leans forward, and for just a moment, Holmes sees her, framed in the window. Irene Adler smiles at him. There is something wistful in the smile, but at the same time, there is humor in her eyes. She is telling him that the two of them will meet again. Then the car drives away. Holmes comes back into the kitchen, followed by Missy. He sets the parcel down on the table. John is making supper, or rather, reheating it. Missy did the cooking earlier. Who was it? John asks. Irene Adler, Missy says. Trouble. Holmes is staring at the parcel as if it might explode in his hands. Missy finds a pair of scissors and hands it to him. Aren't you going to open it? She says. He cuts through the string and opens the box. It is packed with white tissue paper. First of all, he takes out a small bag, which turns out to contain a dozen biscuits, each marked with the monogrammed B of the Bohemia. The actual gift is below. It is a polished wooden box, which in turn opens to reveal a Stradivarius violin. Not a fake. The real thing. John whistles. Is that what I think it is? He asks. What would you want with that? Missy shakes her head. It must be worth a fortune, John says. If you sell it, you could buy another house. I'm not going to sell it, Holmes replies. There is something else in the box. He takes it out and balances it in his hand. His first bow. 2 weeks later, another dinner. But this time the table is laid for three. Although he has continued to spend a lot of time on his own in his room, Sherlock is much more like his old self, and both John and Missy are confident that soon he will join them. John has seen half a dozen patients today, and has rewarded himself with a small glass of whiskey. It's nice to drink it because he wants it, not because he needs it. And then they hear the sound wafting down from upstairs. Sherlock Holmes is playing a tune on the Stradivarius violin. Hesitant at first, the tune grows in strength. They can imagine the bow leaping over the strings. It's something Eastern European, romantic. The rhythm becomes faster and faster. Holmes makes no mistakes. 2 weeks. He had never even seen a violin. He had certainly never played one. But in 2 weeks, and with no instruction, he has achieved this. How is that even possible? As the music echoes around them, John and Missy stare at each other. They still do not know where Sherlock Holmes came from. They have no idea who he really is, but But the question they must ask themselves is, what sort of man is he? What sort of man can master a complicated instrument and rise to the level of a virtuoso in just 2 weeks? What sort of man?
You have listened to Becoming Sherlock 1, The Red Circle, based on an original idea by Anthony Horowitz. Written by Anthony Horowitz and Sarah J. Norton. Copyright 2023, Storytel Original, The Conan Doyle Estate, Limited. Anthony Horowitz and Sarah J. Norton. Narrated by me, Alfred Enoch. This audiobook is produced by Storytel Original 2023.